Bay Soda versus Naples. And then we're ready to hear from the petition.
Good morning, Justices. My name's Mark Torb of the firm of Torb Tucker, LLC in Fort Collins, Colorado. Attorney registration number 704. I'm here representing Mr. Fred Soderberg, the original plaintiff, and obviously the appellant petitioner in this matter. With me at council table is my partner, Charles Tucker, who was on the brief. We really think that the key to the issues that you have set out and the questions which you posed back to us after granting certiorari is tied to a full understanding of the award, to a reading and a comprehension of the award and the effort that Judge Coghlan put into it when he rendered it on August 10 of 2004. The award, as we've repeatedly stated, was 100% in Mr. Soderberg's favor and 0% in Mr. Nakos' favor, except to the extent that Soderberg didn't get punitives and didn't get attorney fees and things of that sort. But everything else that happened in that award is what Soderberg was asking for. And we referred the court back to the initial hearing management brief, which was submitted by Mr. Soderberg, in which Mr. Soderberg said, look, I've been had, I've been stiffed, I've been pushed back, and this stock has a greater value than what Mr. Nakos says. I want that value determined so that I can get that money, and if the remedy for overcoming these problems about this consent that I signed just months before I was fired is to find that there was a breach of the fiduciary duty by Mr. Nakos owed to a minority shareholder, or there was a breach of the concept of good faith and fair dealing owed by Mr. Nakos to the shareholders, so be it. Give me a remedy. Maybe force him to buy my stock and pay me interest on what he should have paid me when a sale should have taken place. And why is the should important there? Because back in November of 2004, Mr. Nakos sent a letter to Mr. Soderberg and said, Mr. Soderberg, your stock's worth $103.68 a share, and so that's what I'll pay you. You better show up and you bring your certificate and we'll have this done. Mr. Soderberg felt, no, it's worth more than that, and he refused to show up. And so the suit ensued, and the arbitrator found at page 17 of his award, record 235, in the year 2003, the year just preceding the termination, Mr. Soderberg, as a 15% owner of SMI, received $262,000 bonus and a dividend of $234,000. If Mr. Nakos, in June of 2004, would have considered that a 15% owner was entitled to receive $496,000, it should be obvious that a 15% ownership was worth more than $150,000.
Well, I understand, but I'm trying to focus on what it is we have to decide here, because there was the arbitrator ended up modifying the award, right? The interest piece of it. I mean,
that's the cycle that we're going to get into, Judge.
Right, I understand that, but could you just help me frame what the legal issue is? It seems to me it's a statutory versus a rule issue, and it's based on whether or not the arbitrator had authority to modify to take out the attorney's fees. I mean,
and that is my next point.
Right?
Yes, sir, and I will speak to that. How did we get to this problem that we're at today? It was exactly what you brought up, Justice Hobbs, that SMI, and then eventually Mr. Nakos, and eventually we call them defendants, sought to have a clarification of the court's award with respect to the interest that Mr. Soderberg had requested. And that is really the right thing to do under the right circumstance. The case that is been bandied about quite a bit and which is before this court in our briefing, the Super Credit Union versus Scholler Group Architects at 113 P3rd 768. And in that case, at page 772, this court said, The statutory authority to modify an award for clarification purposes is only bestowed on the arbitrator. The key there, clarification, and only bestowed. The reviewing court only may correct an evident miscalculation or descriptive mistake, imperfect form, or an award in which the arbitrator reached non-submitted matters. The court directs us to compare sections 1322-11 with 1322-15 of the old act. We have corresponding sections in the revised CUA that we are arguing under today. Point is this, that if there is something that supposedly requires clarification, then that has to go to the arbitrator. How did we get there in this particular case? We got there in a convoluted fashion. The super case has some great parallels. 4 days after the award, Mr. Soderberg applied for confirmation. There was such action taken by Scholar in the super case. He was the prevailing party. Unlike Scholar in the super case, the people at the defendants, SMI and Mr. Nakos, didn't respond. They sat silent. In the super case, the super, which was the owner of the property, responded and said, I want a clarification and a correction. You double charged me here. This has to be cleaned up. Now, the issue is, what is the appropriate way to reach clarification? The way to reach clarification is under 1322-220 sub 1 and 2. Bring it to the arbitrator within 20 days after the award. If you don't, then it would seem to me that you don't have a right to bring it to the arbitrator later. What occurred in our case, however, and this is very interesting if we look back at what happened before the Court of Appeals, the court asked Ms. Vickles, do you oppose Mr. Korb's motion to confirm the award or just sit back and wait? Did you oppose Mr. Korb's motion to confirm the award or just sit back and wait to file a motion to vacate the award? The answer by Ms. Vickles, I wouldn't characterize it as sitting back and waiting. Mr. Korb filed a motion to confirm the award just 4 days after it was entered. At that time, candidly, the defendants had not gone back and focused on the award and the terms of the stock repurchase agreement and had not appreciated that the arbitrator omitted to apply the interest provision in the calculation of the award. But you know what really happened? They hadn't even thought about it, and they hadn't thought about the rules that we're about to get into here as to when the respective duties of a court and an arbitrator spring forth. They weren't waiting because they thought they had 90 days to bring that kind of a thing. They were waiting because they didn't do their due diligence and hadn't figured out what the issues were. They hadn't appreciated the issue. So what did they do? They let us go through a judicial procedure, proper notice, followed the rules, followed the statute, notice, and let us even go further because the issue of interest was targeted. On 2 days after I sent out the motion to confirm, I sent a letter to counsel for the defendants and said, look, here's how I calculate the interest based on the interest statute, based on the time frame set forth in the award, blah, blah, blah. Plain and simple.
Well, it was contrary to the agreement, right?
It was not.
The interest award was not?
The issue was not determined under the agreement. The issue was determined when the arbitrator went on, and there's 14 pages of his award, where he determined this case as a tort. He said that clause is not the price-setting consent signed in 04 is not binding because it was a result of overbearing management by Mr. Nakos. That was the end of the issue. Now we're in tort. We didn't even get into the issue of the other provisions of the stock repurchase agreement, and as the counsel for defendants admitted, they didn't even raise the issue of, hey, Section 2.3 says I have the right not to pay for a year. And, you know, gosh, if I had realized that it was going to be such a big number, I would have exercised that right, but I didn't. So now, gosh, it seems it's only right after we fought for 2 years and it finally turned out that I was wrong and that I oppressed you and I violated your rights, that I should have the right to do something I hadn't done before.
Mr. Corp, excuse me, is that letter in evidence that you just referred to?
I'm sorry, just...
Is the letter in evidence that you just referred to?
Where is that?
The letter. Is the letter you just talked...
It's in the record.
That's all right. And what
and I
was
have
the,
a citation...
What was that? What was the date of the letter?
The letter of demand for Mr. Nakos is dated November 15, 2004.
November 15th?
November 15, 2004. And I give you a specific record cite. I know I've cited it specifically in the briefs.
And that was after, as I understand it, that was after... they asked the arbitrator to clarify the award, right?
No, sir.
I thought they asked the arbitrator to clarify the award on September 17th.
2004 is when Mr. Nakos fired Mr. Soderbergh. We got to the hearing, and the award was entered by the arbitrator August of 2006.
Right.
So what happened is during the course of that hearing, we made it really apparent we weren't going to accept this $150,000. That's why I read you the portion of the arbitrator's ruling. The arbitrator said no one in his right mind would believe that the stock was only worth $150,000. So Mr. Soderbergh was right to oppose being crammed down and to file his lawsuit. And then the arbitrator found in our favor on that whole concept of fiduciary duty and good faith and fair dealing. And then what the arbitrator did is said, you know, the value isn't what Mr. Soderbergh is trying to prove through his expert. The value is what Mr. Nakos' own expert testified to. Seven times what Mr. Nakos was willing to offer. Now, this is going outside of the issues directly in the brief, but it is important to note that what goes on in the arbitration hearing goes on in the arbitration hearing, and what goes on in the court goes on in the court. The court doesn't know what went on in the arbitration hearing, and the arbitrator doesn't know what goes on in the court. They're different games, different duties. We have an acknowledgement by the defendants that they didn't raise 2.3 before the arbitrator. Okay. The arbitrator's award is rather clear and succinct. It says interest from December 31, 2004 shall be paid within 60 days of this award. He could be dead wrong. He could misinterpret the darn agreement completely. It makes no difference. We're in arbitration. He's the final judge of the facts and the law. He can make a mistake. He can be wrong. And if he's wrong, we're stuck with it. So what we have is a situation where defendants came into first the arbitrator in an untimely fashion because they thought they were under the FAA, which is pure hogwash, to use the legalese term. But we were never under the FAA, had no bearing on anything, and nobody even paid any attention to it. So 37 days after the award, the defendants bring a motion to the arbitrator to clarify. Appropriate. Arbitrator should clarify. The CUA says do it within 20 days. They say, well, you know, what we're really doing is we're doing it circuitously. We have 90 days under the FAA to ask the court to modify or correct, and the court could on remand direct the arbitrator to clarify, and so we're saving everybody a lot of time by not going to the court. We're going right to the arbitrator, so they're obviously saying, we know what the court would do anyhow, and we can just blow that off. And, you know, by the way, we don't have to pay any attention to this purported confirmation proceedings and these purported judgments because they were achieved in violation.
Mr. Court, wasn't that denied, and that's not really what the trial court or the Court of Appeals relied on, is it?
I'm sorry, sir?
Wasn't that particular motion denied? And is it not true that neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals particularly relied upon that? So it seems to me we're beyond that in terms of trying to consider what the process is here and whether it was correct pursuant to the statute.
And that's point three. And that's the question number three.
Well, if that's how you're organizing your argument, isn't point number three what's at issue here?
Question number three is, what's the relationship of CRPC 60B with the activities in the Arbitration Act? Defendants argue in their briefing, in their answer brief, that 1322.224 gives the court inherent authority to vacate an award granted, to vacate a judgment granted pursuant to a motion to confirm under 1322.222. And they are ignoring that in the motion that they submitted to the court on October 30 of 2006, they asked the court to act under 60B. He said, you can set this aside for any reason that's just. This court knows, and we have rulings that are cited extensively in the briefing, that you can't use a 60B motion to get a collateral attack on the actual award itself. The issue before the court when you have a judgment is, how did the court act in allowing that judgment to enter? And there is no evidence that Judge Blair did anything wrong at that stage. She was asked. We waited the 18 days after service. She entered a finding, entered the orders, notice of judgment was given, and we have a final judgment. Time for appeal had even expired by the time they got around to their motion on October 30 of 2006. So the key is this, that there are separate duties. A court is asked to enforce an arbitration award. It isn't asked to look at the thing. If there's some crazy little mistake and 2 + 2 is said to equal 5, the court can correct that and make it 2 + 2 = 4. But beyond that, the court can't get into the arbitration award, can't clarify.
Why isn't this a motion, or why shouldn't we think of this as a motion treated by the trial court as under 1322.224 section 1?
I have to apologize, Justice. I have a bad ear. And
I'm sorry. I understand the motion cited Rule 60B. I didn't think the trial court order cited that rule. Why shouldn't we think about this as a trial court order under 1322.224, Section 1, that is a motion for modification filed after within 90 days to the trial court?
I did, and it's been extensively briefed also, because when you get into the very distinction that's made in King Super, a trial court has no authority to clarify. A trial court has the authority to modify or correct on stated grounds, three very, very narrow grounds. And that's it. And those three very, very narrow grounds do not constitute the kind of thing that constitutes clarification. And we need to look at the actual motion. What was their motion on October 30th? Judge, we tardily asked the arbitrator to enter a clarification. They were beyond the 20 days. That's clear patent. And he wouldn't, because you already entered a judgment. We want you to send that same motion back that has been denied and allow the arbitrator now to rule on clarification. Who kicks at the cat? That's what it comes down to. That's what that Minnesota case that we cited to you states, that any clarification, whether sent back on remand from the court or brought as a result of a direct motion to the arbitrator, should come within 20 days. It didn't. We have a situation where the other cases that we have, you will find that the party responded to the motion to confirm by some kind of motion, which maybe ended up being a motion to clarify, maybe ended up being a motion to modify. But they did it within a timely fashion, within the procedures that take place in the courtroom. That's pivotal to the way that we got into this particular maze. Our friends, the defendants, went under the wrong system. If they'd looked at the statute, let's say they'd looked at the old statute, the CUA that was enacted in 1975 and amended in 1973, they talk about that extensively in their brief. That one says any motion to the court or the arbitrator must be brought within 30 days of award. When did they first make their move? 37 days after the award. They were dead in the water, and they made the wrong move because they went back to the arbitrator in the clear face of the 1322-220 sub 2 and didn't go back to the court until much later, albeit within 90 days. There's no question about that. But by that particular point in time, the judgment was entered, final, appealable. What were we supposed to do? I tried to enforce the judgment, and I had actually collected the balance that was owed. And Judge Blair, when she made her ruling on December 20th, 2006, made me get the money back to Mr. Sotover and put it back into the court. She didn't go all the way and say, you know, that judgment's void, therefore the garnishment's void, therefore give the money back to the bank. She sort of held it.
Counsel, can I get you to just retrace the steps in your argument, just so I understand it? I mean, essentially, you're saying that 1322.224, the court could not act under that because this is not an evident mathematical miscalculation or evident mistake in the description of a person, thing, or property.
I'm saying that the court could, if properly approached, act under that. But I'm saying that the statute does not confer on the court authority to vacate a judgment it had rendered pursuant to the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure some 45, 65 days earlier.
I'm trying to figure out, though, so your argument is not based on the actual scope of 224?
It is based on the interrelationship between 60B and the whole CUA, and that is the court enforces the award, the arbitrator determines the award, only the arbitrator can clarify award, the court can make minor technical corrections, the super case control set. Am I fair with that answer?
Okay, I think you're telling me that this doesn't fall under 1322.224.1A. I thought you answered no earlier when I asked the question, but yes, you say this does not fall within the super kind of definition of minor errors.
224 does not allow a court to clarify. 224 does not allow a court to vacate a previously entered judgment that is valid and enforceable under the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure.
Okay, then help me understand why Rule 60 wouldn't work.
It could, but you have to have grounds, and there were no grounds given. If we look at the motion that was submitted, it said you can do this for any reason you want, and there were no grounds shown. There's no excusable neglect. There was none of this kind of thing that normally would apply under 60B motion, which could have the effect of taking an otherwise permanent, fixed, final judgment and reopening it. Also, keep in mind that we're in a situation where in arbitration there's no bonding or anything like that if you sit somebody and don't pay the bill. There is in CRP 60, there in the whole Rules of Civil Procedure, and we had actually proceeded with collection, and then we were forced to look back and turn that money back.
So Rule 60 doesn't work because it wasn't followed. The dictates weren't
exactly
followed.
Right.
Okay,
well, the judge didn't rely on Rule 60 either, did it? I'm here. So the judge didn't rely on Rule 60 either, did she?
You know, we don't know what she said, what she relied on.
Well, she didn't state that she was relying upon it. There's no written order.
No, there is a written order that says the confirmation is vacated. We went through this horrible mess in the Court of Appeals because everybody understood that confirmation means that the judgment's vacated, and yet that's not what the court did later on when it satisfied a vacated judgment. It was a horrible mess that only the record can explain that fully. May I reserve the rest of my time, Justices?
You may.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and members of the court. I'm Joseph Berneski, and I guess my background is in arbitration, sitting for the American Arbitration Association and the Denver Fee Arbitration Committee. But I'm coming here today to talk essentially about the three specific issues that the court has identified and how the actions of the Court of Appeals and the trial court conformed with the proper procedure under Colorado law. Let me make a preliminary point, and that is, as Mr. Korb said, there was some dispute as to whether or not the federal act applied or whether the state act applied. Initially, there was evidence in the record that Soderberg Masonry did engage in interstate commerce, but your honors have identified issues under the state act, and my argument will be based upon that. The second point was what Mr. Korb raised about whether or not the old act or the new act is applicable. And what happened was that the Colorado legislature adopted the new act in 2004. And the parties have always proceeded under the assumption and the conviction that the 2004 act is applicable. And that allows 90 days for a party to move for certain type of relief. And I'll get into that fairly quickly. Let's talk a little bit about the three issues which have been identified. Issue number one, and I'll paraphrase here, forgive me if I don't catch the gist of the court's questions. Issue one is, if a party seeks confirmation and obtains a confirmation, does the defending party still have a 90-day period in order to seek to modify the award or to clarify it or to have it vacated? And that essentially is an issue of a statutory interpretation. The trial court and the Court of Appeals thought that the statutes were very clear, and that is that a premature confirmation does not affect the 90 days that an opposing party has to seek remedies against the arbitration award. Now, your honors identified an issue about whether or not the 90 days was affected. So I think perhaps what you're saying is, you know, there could be some ambiguity there. And the question is, what do you do in the case of ambiguity?
Well, let me just clarify now.
Yes, sir.
The presentation. The court actually went ahead and confirmed the award earlier than 90 days.
It did.
Now what about your client? Why wasn't your client in there objecting to that confirmation that quickly?
I think the easy answer is because my client knew that he had 90 days. And I think this is not on the record, but he did not have to make the payment until 60 days after the award. And so he started sharpening the pencil sometime as that 60-day period got closer. And you know, frankly, Your Honor, I can't answer that question with certainty because the lawyer who was handling it passed away very prematurely, and I can't talk to him about that. Let me talk about what might be an ambiguity here. And once again, going back to the issue of how do you resolve an ambiguity, and the answer in this case is surprisingly easy, because we can go to the legislative history of the enactment of the 2004 Uniform Act. And I think what you see our brief, you will note that the Colorado legislature wanted to adopt the position of the National Conference on Commissioners on Uniform Laws. And the commentary to the section in question basically says that if the winning party files a motion to confirm prior to 90 days after the arbitrator gives notice of the award, the losing party can either file a motion to vacate or modify at that time, or file a motion to vacate or modify within the 90-day statutory period. So what the state legislature is saying to you by adopting the position of the Uniform Commissioners is a party like my client has 90 days to oppose the award, to seek remedies, and that is regardless of whether or not confirmation has been entered.
But isn't what's confusing here is the fact that your client filed that motion within 90 days, but with the arbitrator as opposed to the district court?
Did two things. There was indeed a motion with the arbitrator right after the confirmation was made. And Judge Coughlin said, you know, since there's been a confirmation, I don't have jurisdiction.
Right.
But then there was a motion filed with Judge Blair within 90 days saying, Judge Blair, would you please either clarify or modify the award on your own or send it back to the arbitrator for action? So we were perfectly timely with that.
Well, Mr. Pernesky, then could you run why that motion was granted under 1322.224?
Yes.
What's the theory?
What Judge Blair said in her written decision, she went under 224.1C and found, in her opinion, that the award was imperfect as a matter of form.
Well, that raises two issues to me. One is the statute says a correction of award, and now you have the judgment confirming an award. So why is that statute operative?
The 224?
Yes.
Because it allows a vacation of the arbitration award.
Well, but this wasn't an award. This was a judgment by the court. So it's a judgment of an arbitration, a confirmed judgment of award. So that seems to me to take it out of the wording of Section 1322.224. And if not, why not?
Well, I think the best way to approach that is that the statute doesn't address one way or the other what happens if you have a confirmation. It doesn't say if there has been a confirmation, you can't use this statute.
But it doesn't. Oh, wait a minute. Here's what I have trouble with. One is under 222, there's no time limit. Period.
Correct.
Secondly, it seems to me that what Mr. Korb said is generally correct, that a judgment that's confirmed is a judgment. And so it would be taken totally out of the arbitration statute because of the use of the word award. Now, what's wrong with that reasoning? I mean, that's how at least I'm thinking about it.
You're raising a legitimate question regarding the interpretation of the statute. And I think that is answered by the legislative history of the 2004 Act. In other words, the National Conference of Commissioners saying, if there is a confirmation that has been made within the 90 days, a party can still file for relief under 224 or 220.
I heard you make that. I don't mean to. It just seems to me that then the word award is not used technically.
Correct. The commissioners, with all their troubles, weren't able to really address that issue as crisply as they should have. But once again, I think the legislative history is clear. And not only that, but you would find the same type of analysis under the Federal Arbitration Act, which we cite in our brief. Back in 1924, the Joint Committees on the Judiciary reached the same conclusion. And that is, even if you have a confirmation, you can still move to modify.
So we shouldn't take any credence or pay any attention to the fact that your client sought a motion under 60B-5?
That's correct. Because what I have to defend today is a decision of the Court of Appeals. That's what you are reviewing. And not some argument which wasn't adopted by the trial court or by the Court of Appeals.
Could I follow up on that before you leave this point?
Yes.
Totally. From your last answer, it sounds to me like you're saying, before, I thought you were, in effect, arguing the relationship between these two, in the briefs anyway, between these two rules, meant that the court did not have authority to enter a confirmation until your opportunity, until your 90-day opportunity to challenge the award was passed. But now it sounds like you're not saying that. You're saying you could have a confirmation and yet you could still be allowed to challenge the award?
That's affirmative. And I'll admit that earlier in this case, the argument that we were making was that a court really couldn't act until the 90-day period was over. Judge Blair didn't think very much of that argument. The Court of Appeals didn't think very much of that argument. I'm not going to try to sell it to you today.
So what's the effect then? I mean, then it does seem to me to raise a kind of a conceptual problem along the lines that Justice Bender was raising. If you have a confirmation of the award, and yet you're saying after the award has legitimately been confirmed, you can go challenge the award.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, and take an analogy if you would. Under, and I'm not saying that Rule 60B applies, I've been told by the Court of Appeals that it doesn't, but let's suppose you have a judgment after a trial before a judge. That is a judgment which is entered of record. But there still is the opportunity to set that judgment aside under Rule 60B. Now consider how 60B tracks with the Arbitration Act. For example, under the Arbitration Act, you can set aside a arbitration award if you can demonstrate that the award was procured by fraud. Now you have 90 days under the Arbitration Act to do that. Under Rule 60B, you have the same right, and that is a right that you have for 6 months. So it is not the end of the day when you say there's a judgment entered, you can't do anything about it. Really, the question is, as a matter of statute, what is it can you do and how are your rights limited? Another example is under Rule 60B, you can have a judgment vacated because of newly found evidence. Under the Arbitration Act, you can't do that. So you have to basically look at the statute and figure out where are you? Arbitration.
Is it true or not, as your opposing counsel said, that this issue of the interest was not raised in front of the arbitrator the first time?
In the sense of taking the rifle shot at the interest, you're quite correct. But more broadly, both parties were saying to the arbitrator, apply the stock repurchase agreement.
They both said that, but then the arbitrator put in the award. Where did this interest award come from, this $96,000? Why was it able to happen before the arbitrator without contest by your client? Why wasn't a motion made within 20 days to the arbitrator to correct that based on the agreement?
Well, I think typically, and this goes outside the record, that when people try an arbitration case to me, they don't spend a lot of time arguing about when interest will commence. But when I write the award, I've got to put something in for prejudgment interest. And I imagine that's what happened here. The party said, look, Judge Coghlan, apply the stock repurchase agreement. He said, fine, I'll do that. And then he just missed the clause.
Well, I'm trying to sort out the remedial provisions that allow you to reopen an award in a situation where it was plainly in the face of your client. It's a pretty big amount of money. And the arbitrator's not asked to get it right as it's on its way to the court the first time.
That's correct.
Well, isn't that the built-in problem here?
Well, it is if you make it the problem. And what I mean by that is that we still have the right within 90 days to ask for a clarification of the award. And whether we did it within 20 days or not, if you look at the statute, that's what it says.
That's what I'm after, is what right. Clarification of the award means.
Well,
it doesn't seem to me there was any ambiguity in the award. The award was for $96,000 in interest, right?
That's correct. And the question, though, to the arbitrator was, your award consistently applied the stock repurchase agreement. You have, however, deviated from the stock repurchase agreement in the form of your award of interest. Did you mean to do that? And it's just like the Super Credit Union. You consistently adjusted the wage rates, but you didn't do it under general conditions. Did you mean to do that? And that is what a clarification is all about.
So there's 90 days to do that after.
Absolutely.
It proceeds.
And that brings me to my second point.
All right.
Because I think that the legislative history demonstrates that a confirmation does not shorten the 90-day period. And I think that's the case under both the Federal Act and the State Act. Now, as to the second issue, Mr. Corbin and I have got a difference of opinion. And I think you can resolve that by looking at the statute. And the question is, when can you go back to the arbitrator to say to the arbitrator, did you really mean that? And the Colorado statute has two different time periods. The first time period, and this is the one that Mr. Corp has referred to, is the period of 20 days after the award, when a party can go right back to the arbitrator and say, did you really mean that? But there's a second period of time, which he forgot to mention, and that is that the trial court has the ability to remand a case to the arbitrator if a motion has been filed to modify or correct within 90 days. Under those circumstances, if a motion is filed within 90 days, the judge has the right to go back to the arbitrator and say, look, you handle this thing. It's your mess. Straighten it out.
Spernowski, I think I understand you incorporate subsection 4 of 220
yes.
to get to that argument, right?
That's
well,
absolutely right.
But that doesn't, I mean, I think it's true that 224 says 90 days, but 220 could also be incorporating the 20 days, right?
Only
I mean,
subsection
from statutory,
one.
Only subsection?
Yes, that's correct. And the reason is...
Ah, you're right.
Under subsection 2,
you're right.
It says you got to make it within 20 days. Now, you've just highlighted an important distinction, Justice Bender, and that is Mr. Korb relies upon a Minnesota case and a Minnesota statute. And I filed that statute with you about 10 days ago. And guess what? That statute is different. There is subsection 1 saying you can go to an arbitrator and ask him for a clarification. There's a subsection 2, and it says if the judge wants to send it back forward to the arbitrator, the judge can do that. And subsection 3 says if you're going under either subsection 1 or subsection 2, you've got to do it within 20 days. So the Minnesota statute is completely different from what we have before us here.
Mr. Bronski, assuming that... we're not talking here about the 20 days in the first motion, that instead your 60B motion is considered to have been regarded by the trial court under 224, therefore is allowed within 90 days, and assuming, consistent with your argument, that that also allows the modification, notwithstanding the fact that there has been a confirmation. So assuming that, you had said earlier in response to a question that Judge Blair found the award to be imperfect in form.
Yes.
Which would seem to at least suggest that it is appropriate pursuant to 1322-224C. And if I'm understanding 224 right, it is either A or C that would allow the matter to be sent back to the arbitrator. So it seems to me that you have to be under A or C. I think when you were asked about that earlier, your answer was, well, Judge Blair found it under C. So is that correct? I'm having a little bit of trouble substantively with how this could fit under C.
Yes, and I think you and I are maybe getting mixed up on our alphabets, so
all right.
Let me see if I'm tracking you. Subsection, let's go back to 224. And what that essentially says is that you can correct the modified award. I'm sorry, are we on 224?
Yeah, 224, okay. It says you can correct or modify an award if it's imperfect as a matter of form, which is what I thought you
yes.
said Blair had
that,
done.
That is what Judge Blair found. You're
and
absolutely
if
right.
that's right, then it seems that, I think at least your argument is, that means the court can send it back to the arbitrator for modification, which is what Blair did.
Yes.
And that's all within, because the motion's within 90 days.
Yes.
That then relates back to 220, section 4, which sort of confirms that the arbitrator can modify pursuant to the court order.
Yes.
But what's missing, it seems to me, in your argument is why the substance of what you're asking to be changed here actually fits under subsection C. That is, were you really attacking this award as imperfect as a matter of form? Was it the form that was imperfect, or wasn't it something outside of C?
Let me preface with two comments. First, it's as ambiguous as the Dickens as to what imperfect as to form means. If you look at the report of the National Commissioners, they don't tell us. So then the question is, well, could imperfect as the form be that the award as written appears to be inconsistent because it is applying the stock repurchase agreement but not applying it when the interest calculation comes up? I think that would fall within the imperfect as the form. And what I would emphasize, Your Honor, is imperfection. It just isn't right. It doesn't ring right. And Mr. Arbitrator, Judge Coghlan, please clarify what you meant by that. But second, there's another thing that you should consider when you're writing the opinion in this case, and that is it necessary to satisfy one of those tests before you, did you have to show that the award is imperfect as to form in order to get the court, the arbitrator, to clarify it?
Are you asking whose decision is it, whether it's imperfect as to form, the trial courts or the arbiters? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that in order to send a decision back to the arbitrator may not require a showing of imperfection as to form, because you would be under 220 sub 4. And all that requires is that there be a motion pending. And it says if there is a motion pending, the court can send the case back to the arbitrator.
So you think Section 4 of 220 operates independently of 224?
You know, I think it does, because
doesn't that leave it loose without any time restrictions?
No. Because it says that there has to be 220 sub 4 requires a motion to be pending, and I would think you'd have to read into that that it has to be properly pending and has to be filed within the 90 days.
Well, that takes you back to 224, right? But you want to incorporate the 90 days from 224, but not the rest of it?
No, all it says is that if there is a motion that is pending, one of the things the judge can do, if he or she wants, is to remand the case to the arbitrator for clarification. And that's all 220 sub 4 says. It doesn't say there has to be a prima facie showing that there's a need for modification or what have you. So that's what the argument is. Now, that's going a step further.
Let me ask
further.
You a different question about the same thing, and that is, and for leaving that aside, that is whether the court can send it back for modification beyond the bounds of A and C under the notion that the arbiter has more authority under 220. Setting that aside, my question instead is this issue of, or was this issue of whether it substantively fits under subsection C raised and preserved? Is that something we should address?
Well, it was determined by Judge Blair that that is the proper section to apply in order to send it back. And there was a general, I hope I'm reciting the record correct, a general citation to 220 and to 224.
Well, yes, but the question is, was an appeal taken from that raising the question of whether it substantively fit under Section C, or was the appeal entirely a matter about the timing here?
I don't recall what Mr. Corp's notice of appeal said on that, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals treated it as having been properly raised, and I would suggest that this court can easily do the same thing.
But they didn't address it, did they?
I don't think so.
Whether it was a 224AC1C, I'm sorry, a vacation 1C. I don't believe that the Court of Appeals did.
Mr. Brunowski, are you making this argument that it's irrelevant almost because there was a pending motion made under 224 within 90 days, therefore subsection 220 subsection 4 applies? That's your argument?
Yes.
Okay.
So, and it's really a fallback argument. Either you don't have to have any showing whatsoever. If the trial court believes that the assistance of the arbitrator will be a great help, the court can send that back without making any findings. But the next position, and the higher up position, is that Judge Blair found that the award was imperfect as to form because it was plain to her that 2.3 should have been applied, and for some reason the arbitrator just didn't do it.
What I find difficult is the larger piece of your argument, and you answered it before about legislative history. But it seems to me they had a set statutory procedures that were passed by the legislature. And then you have, you know, regular old judgment rules that have been, you know, followed in all other cases. And I'm having trouble meshing the two simply on the basis that legislative history of the adoption of the Uniform Act indicates that a ward doesn't just mean a ward. And I'm wondering, you know, can you give me any other reason why we should say a statutory procedure should correct a judgment when it doesn't really indicate that? I mean, I'm having trouble seeing there's two parallel tracks here, the arbitration statute itself, and then, of course, our rules of civil procedure.
Right. I think there's two answers to that. The first is Rule 81 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure, and Mr. Korb spoke quite a bit about that. And that basically said that the rules of civil procedure do not govern procedure and practice in any special statutory proceeding insofar as they are inconsistent or in conflict with the procedure and practices provided by the applicable statute. So I think what you have then, Your Honors, is a hybrid. The rules of civil procedure could apply to, say, execution on a judgment that has been entered pursuant, you know, 104, 103, et cetera. However, the actual procedure for vacating the arbitration award itself is something that is set by the statute as with the intent set out by the Colorado legislature. The second way of looking at it would be probably to take a look at a Court of Appeals decision, which in fact Mr. Korb cited, and that's the Sportsman's Quick Stop versus Divinato. That was a Court of Appeals decision in 2001. And what a party tried to do there was to attack a arbitration award under Rule 60. And the Court of Appeals said that a Rule 60B motion to vacate a judgment is not a proper vehicle to challenge the merits of the underlying arbitration award, as the Uniform Arbitration Act provided the exclusive means to challenge acts that taint an arbitration decision. So, once again, you have a dichotomy. Let's suppose that somebody goes into court and has a forged arbitration award and gets the court to confirm that. That's probably a Rule 60B motion because it's fraud upon the court, and it's not necessarily an attack upon the award itself. Now, let's suppose somebody comes in and says, boy, the arbitrator was so stupid, he gave the wrong weight to the evidence. That is an attack upon the arbitration award, and you have to use Section 224 or 223 or 220 to attack that. And there's a good reason for that. Let's remember I was talking about the idiosyncrasies before of Rule 60B and the arbitration. Let's suppose that somebody came in and they had the motion confirming the award vacated because of newly discovered evidence. That's perfectly proper under Rule 60B. But at the same time, they can't attack the award itself because that's not a ground for attacking the award under the Arbitration Act. So what happens then is you got an award that stands, but there's no way you can enforce it. And what you really have to do then is meld the statute with the intent of the legislature and what you're really trying to accomplish. So it's not very easy to do, but with a little bit of thought.
Well, let me take a run at this again. Here's what concerns me about this case, is that it appears that if you give a reasonable construction to the statute, the district court's role is very narrow. And the idea that form includes substance is disturbing. It seems to me that if we wrote that, we would be opening up for a district court to characterize any kind of a substantive ruling and require an arbitrator to relook at it. It seems to me that the statute requires matters of substance to be brought before the arbitrator within 20 days, and you have 90 days for the form. Now, when you look at the issues in the case here, and even in the Court of Appeals, as I think Justice Martinez pointed out, that really hasn't been focused on. Yet both of you are asking for some kind of statutory construction that seems to turn on what this really was. Is it a problem with form or a problem with substance? So how do we avoid the quandary here, or how do we deal straight on with the statutory interpretation and the reason that we took this case? So are we only talking about timing, and we're going to ignore this problem about form and substance, or are we going to address it? What's your view?
I think we ought to address it, but I think we have a problem with the definitions.
Okay.
Because you're using form and substance, and I think we go back to Justice Rice's opinion in the Super Credit Union case. And really the test there is whether or not the arbitrator is being asked to redetermine the merits of his or her decision. And so
and the merits don't include this interest award?
No.
In this case?
And if you didn't ask us to take a look at 60A, but there is case law under 60A that said, and that allows clerical modifications to judgments.
Right.
There's a lot of case law that says that there's a mistake about interest. You can modify that mistake without affecting the merits of the judgment.
Okay.
And also, to go back to the analysis in Super Credit Union, the judge from day one wanted to apply the stock repurchase agreement, and he didn't change his intent. Thank you.
The interrelationship between arbitration and the court system. Is it to be meaningful, efficient, effective, responsive? You have a situation where after 2 years of battle, an award was rendered. And the award says, in clean, plain English, interest on this sum shall be paid from December 31, 2004 until paid. You have an award that says this award is to be honored within 60 days, not 90 days, 60 days. So we move to confirm. You're sitting out here in your office and you're thinking to yourself, you know, I got 90 days to go to the court to seek modification or correction. And perhaps impliedly in that is the ability to get the court to actually delegate clarification back to the arbitrator, even if I forget to ask the arbitrator within the 20 days allowed by 222 sub 1. So I'm going to ignore the court. And I'm going to call that a purported confirmation and a purported judgment. It's meaningless. That's the problem. What kind of system are we operating under here?
Could I just ask you, I sort of lost track in all of this discussion. What are we talking about? What was the total of the award and how much is the interest as?
The award was about $1.3 million in principal stock and improperly withheld earnings, and about $250,000 total in interest. If you add it all in, we got about $1.5 million of that because he kept the first year.
And you're arguing about 1 year's worth of interest?
Correct.
And how much is that worth?
$96,000 at the time. It's about $105,000 now.
Uh-huh.
It's serious money. I mean, the fact of it is, I think Justice Bender and maybe Justice Hobbs got to the point that it's form versus substance. The claim is, by counsel, that we argued that this was under the SRA. That's false, and you wouldn't know it one way or the other anyhow. We argued there was a tort committed, and my man was harmed. And I wanted a remedy, which included potentially forcing him to buy my man's stock. You know, it could be that the judge would say
the arbitration decision turned. Did not the arbitration decision turn on a stock repurchase agreement?
No, Your Honor.
Wasn't that what it was all about?
The reference to the stock repurchase agreement was with respect to the determination of something called fair value. The stock repurchase agreement had a concept different from standard fair market value. And so the only thing that we could reach was, Mr. Nakos, for 7 years, you've never given me any information so I can figure out what the fair value of my stock is. And now you're telling me I have to sell it for $103, which is exactly what I paid for it. This doesn't sound right. And so we had to go in and show that the true value, the fair value, was seven times what was claimed by Mr. Nakos. So that's why I read you that part from the arbitration award at the very beginning. That's what happened. I have to make a couple of other quick points. Number one, everybody says the statutes are not ambiguous. If they're not ambiguous, where's statutory construction even come into the ballgame? Number two, if a motion to confirm is brought, and you're saying, well, I got 90 days, it doesn't say that in 222 that you've got 90 days. 222 does not have the language of the old act saying within the time limitations here and after provided in part two, doesn't have any of that stuff. Why don't you alert the court that we have an issue? How do you construe 222? Do you incorporate some other statute into 222?
Are you making a waiver argument?
There is a waiver argument.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am. When the motion is before the court, all issues should be brought before the court. Well, I want confirmation. You don't think I'm entitled to it. I should wait 90 days. Why don't you tell the court that? How much is that going to hurt you? Does it take you the effort? Or was it really what Ms. Bickle said in appellate argument? We hadn't appreciated the way this came out factually. And if that's the case, that is substance, not form. That is merit, not mathematical error that can be corrected within the award. So what we're shooting at is that they set the scene for creating a huge problem, tremendous drain on court resources, all the way up to this court, which would not have had to occur had they come in and said, you know, I don't think you can bring a motion to confirm for at least 90 days. You have to sit on your award. In which case, I would have said, well, what am I going to do when the award says it's supposed to be paid within 60 days? Well, then I'd probably say, well, maybe that means you got 60 days. Or we got 60 days, not 90 days. Fine. Get it in front of the court. Let the court apply its resources. Let's get a determination. Thank you, sir.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank you for your arguments. The case stands submitted, and the court will...